The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, college textbooks can be a necessary part of coursework, but they're often pricey. A new report examines automatic textbook billing programs. And a new effort is seeking to assist college presidents in preparing students for civic life. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Textbooks are an often necessary and expensive part of college coursework. A popular practice among colleges and universities is to provide students with automatic textbook billing. While it may mean students don't have to worry about starting a course with an incomplete set of books, it raises questions about whether the practice is in the students' financial interests. A report from Student Pergs examined 171 contracts for course materials at 92 institutions and says that students enrolled in automatic billing programs have fewer ways to save on the cost of education. To learn more, I spoke with report co-author and Student Pergs National Political Director, Don Shia.
One thing to know about the Student Pergs is that we're a national network of student-run nonprofits. And so college and university students decide the campaigns that we run. They look at the issues that impact them and then tell the staff what to look into. And they brought it to us and went, hey, actually, there's this new thing that's happening where we are being billed for our course materials, not being told that we can opt out, and then not being told how to opt out once we figure out that this is how we're being provided our course materials. And so once we learned about that, we went, okay, how widespread is it? How does this impact the free market where students get to actually choose how they want to get their course materials? How does this impact faculty? And is it fulfilling the promises that these programs make, that they're going to be more affordable and more accessible for students? So that's how we decided to take a look at the issue.
So essentially the way it works is colleges and universities have agreements in place with the textbook publishers, correct? And then there's a transaction that happens between the bookstore and the college, and then it's passed along to the student, and then the money is reimbursed to the parties that be. Could you sort of help me break down how exactly it happens?
Yeah. So it either happens between a publisher or a digital company that aggregates a bunch of online textbooks and the school itself or a third-party bookstore. So in one way or another, it's a company that provides textbooks and then some entity at the school. And they say, okay, we'll provide these resources, but in order to actually get the discount, you have to get a certain percentage of the students opted in or have a quota. So many of these contracts create a financial incentive to minimize the number of students who opt out of them. And this is actually a selling point for these programs. One auto billing program advertises that they have a, quote, 90% sell-through rate, which translates to higher net revenues for publishers and schools. So it's no wonder that so many students that we talk to say that they don't know that they were enrolled in the program. And once they found out they were, they couldn't find out how to opt out. And anecdotally, how these programs work is not really advertised to students or to faculty. We actually know of students who've had to pay for optional books through these auto billing programs because their professors didn't know that the students would be automatically charged if they include the optional books in the program. So it's clear that there's an incentive to have students opt in and not have them look at other options.
So I would guess that if I was maybe a first-year student and I was enrolling in a college and I was about to take my first college courses, I might see a value in saying, hey, the school is providing the textbooks. I don't have to go run around to the bookstore. I don't have to find something that might be sold out. It's a guaranteed thing. On day one, I'll have my books. And then I think about later in college when I was doing everything I could to try to avoid purchasing textbooks. So Is this a trend that you've seen where students, you know, maybe they were enrolled at first and they might have thought it was a good idea, and then as the reality of the costs of textbooks sinks in, that they're saying, hey, I don't really like these automatic payments. I don't really like this plan.
What you're getting at is exactly the problem, which is that auto billing sets off a chain reaction that reduces choices and reduces savings options for students. And these contracts seem to incentivize campuses and bookstores to stop students from opting out. And, you know, it's been a while since I've taken economics, but I'm pretty sure that reducing consumer choice and market competition is not a recipe for creating savings. And what you're noting is that there are better ways to do this. Students shouldn't have to opt out. They should be able to opt in. And if they do find value in these programs and how effective and easy it is for them to get the resources, and they don't mind possibly paying more, that's great. They'll all opt in if it's such a great program. If they do indeed save students money, what we looked at in our report was, okay, do we actually have the receipts? Because they're claiming that they're saving students money, but we were able to find no evidence of that. And it is true that the cost of college textbooks is no longer rising at, you know, 8 times the rate of inflation like they were for 20 years. And that's a good thing. But to say that it's because of these programs is absolute correlation, not causation, right? You may as well say Taylor Swift became astronomically popular at the same time that the cost of textbooks stopped rising. So therefore, Taylor Swift made the college textbooks market way cheaper. It's absurd, right? What we do know is that open textbooks, which are free and you can remix them and students can actually download them for without paying anything, the usage of free open source textbooks has increased 50% in the same time period that the cost of college textbooks has decreased. So you don't need a receipt for that because those are free. It's just very clear that those are directly saving students money. And we have some students who have 3 out of the 4 classes have no cost of textbooks or course resources. And, you know, there are some campuses where they're like, yeah, I don't really need to work on this campaign. We're doing fine. And then you have other campuses which have these programs where our students are like, man, this is just absurd because when I came in, I didn't even know that this was a thing. And then all of a sudden, I got billed $240. I didn't even know it was coming. And then the next year, I went, okay, what are all the ways that I can opt out? And one of the more nefarious features, I guess, or bugs of these programs is that students often have to opt in order to actually do their homework or take their quizzes or tests. And so one thing that proponents of the program will say is that students who opt out do worse. It's like, yeah, no duh, because they literally can't submit their homework, so they're actively taking a cut in their grade, and they know that they are. So we've talked to students who are like, yeah, I just can't afford this access code. I can't afford to opt in. There's no other options of getting it because I literally can't do my homework, but I just can't afford it this semester. So I'm just going to take a 20% hit to my grade because I can't afford this book.
Wow. So students would rather just take the hit on their semester grade than pay for the textbook.
For some that are on the margins and they're already taking on so many hours of work, they're making the choice between eating, paying their rent, or paying their textbooks. And in the past, you could just borrow the book from the library or get it on reserve. You could borrow the book from a friend. And you never had to pay to actually do your homework or take the quizzes. And so it creates a really difficult tension for students who don't have the resources to pay for the brand new book.
How popular are these automatic billing programs right now? Are they growing in popularity in the U.S.?
We did our first review of contracts in 2020, and this is our second review. We reviewed 170-some contracts, which cover schools that enroll more than 1 million students. And in our first report, we recommended ways that these contracts could benefit students. And unfortunately, we did not find that the contracts have improved. And the last survey, which I can send you the link, the last survey of how popular these contracts were saw an increase across the country of universities, which makes sense because these contracts create a financial incentive to minimize the number of students who opt out, and the bookstores often give a portion of their financial gains to the universities when students buy from the automatic billing program.
What's the average price that a student will pay for their one semester of books?
It's really hard to know, and that's the other difficult thing with these programs. It's really difficult to know apples to apples. So my colleague was buying books for her son going into college, and the automatic program was 4 months, and you could buy the access code somewhere else through another digital provider for 3.5 months. And then there was another one that had 1 year access, and none of them were parallel to each other. Some of them had additional workbooks that were included. Others had audio file that were included. None of them were unbundled. So you couldn't just go, okay, here's the unbundled book. I only want that. And it is $10 a month. And that's just how you pay for it. And so that's one of the ways that they make it confusing for consumers, is because it's not an unbundled product. So it kind of is throwing back to the days where you had the Saran wrap around the CD and the workbook and the textbook itself. And then you went, okay, you have to buy this whole thing. And so it's hard to know apples to apples what it actually looks like. But we know that students pay $100, $200, $300 for an access code. And I think it's functionally way worse, because oftentimes you pay for it for a semester, and then the next semester you take Physics 2 and you need that same book again. So you have to pay for that access code again. Some students have the access code expire before their final test, and so then they have to like get a trial period. Other students don't see the value of having the whole book, because they don't know if the professor is going to use the whole thing. So they'll just get a trial and try to do all their homework in the 2.5 week trial that they have before they even have even taken the course. So students are finding ways to get around it, but none of them are particularly good for their actual learning or education.
I want to ask you about what you think about college libraries, because there are some discussions in some college and university systems about doing away with a physical brick and mortar library and moving more materials online. Now, authors have said, you know, if the course is taught at the college or university, that the textbook needs to be in the school library, but I don't know if we can count on that being a guarantee. So, how do you see this going as more materials are moved into the digital realm and students may not have that ease of access of going and picking up a book in their campus library or making photocopies of a textbook in the campus library? What do you think the future holds?
I think the future is in open education resources or open textbooks. So these are books that professors and experts can write with an open license, and they are often peer-reviewed and often can come with workbooks and homework and quizzes. And it offers a couple of advantages. So one, it's digital, so it provides immediate access, just like your typical access code or automatic billing course resource. And two, it's free, so we love that. And it removes that economic barrier for students who have already paid for tuition, have already paid for housing. And three, it allows professors to create course materials that are more relevant for their local community and speak to their local community. So professors can remix these books. They can add more diverse examples that are relevant to their students. They can add in anything that they particularly want to teach that maybe the textbook didn't originally have. And so there are some really good studies out there that find that the completion rates with open textbooks are actually higher than with the traditional textbook overall. And since 2015, there's been a 50% increase in professors saying that they've used open textbooks in their courses. And that has really saved students a lot of money and increased their educational experience overall. The other thing that libraries are doing, and I think librarians overall are very well aware of this problem. They have a lot of students coming to them and say, hey, what's the other option? I can't afford this. And they're often allies in the fight to make course materials more affordable, is that they can negotiate deals with publishers and then provide that digital resource to students more broadly. And so I think a lot of them are well aware of those options and fighting for students in that way. So physical or digital, I think librarians and libraries are a good place, both where OERs can be developed and where traditional, you know, copyrighted books can be provided online.
Now, Dawn, I wanted to ask you a question. I enrolled in college almost 19 years ago. I graduated high school in 2005. So I enrolled in the fall of 2005. I still have a biology textbook that's now 19 years old. Do you have any college textbooks still on your shelf at home?
You know, I was kind of like you. I tried to PDF all of them and find them for free and get them on reserves. So I actually don't have any physical books because I had them all in paper that I photocopied. But that's one of the benefits, right, is that you can have these. My partner does. She got her PhD in communications, and she's got a lot of books from college, more theoretical books, too high bar for me. But you can access those down the line, and that's one of the big barriers with automatic billing is that they last for 3-4 months, and then you no longer have that resource that you can look back on.
I think I just didn't want to get rid of mine because I paid so much for it.
You're getting your money's worth.
Dawn Chia, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was great chatting with you.
Dawn Chia is Student Perg's National Political Director. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The Institute for Citizens and Scholars, a nonprofit with a mission to foster civic engagement, is bringing college presidents together. The College Presidents for Civic Preparedness Initiative has grown to include more than 60 campus leaders and promotes critical inquiry, free expression, and civil discourse at colleges and universities. To learn more about the effort, The Best of Our Knowledge's Jody Cowan spoke with Rajiv Vinakota, president of the Institute for Citizens and Scholars.
Presidents continued to say two things when we talked about civic preparation. The first was that the pendulum had really swung too far in higher ed being viewed largely as what I'll call a private good, right? So you go to school, you pay tuition so you can develop certain skills so you can get a job and a career. That's exceedingly important, right? That's a role of higher education. But higher education also has a public good responsibility to develop citizens and to think about its role in bolstering our democracy. And frankly, the pendulum had swung too far, and we needed to bring that back into balance. The second concept, which is connected but different, was that presidents told us that when they wanted to take bold initiatives on this issue, that it was very difficult because the pushback from students, faculty, administrators, board, donors, alumni, and policymakers made it almost impossible to sustain that work. And so we said, would there be value if we created a coalition of the willing? Like, think of it as almost like collective power to bring these presidents into conversations. And so virtually first, and then in person, we started to convene these presidents and said, how can we as a group really focus around civic preparation? And so we went public in 2023 with a focus around three major projects. One was, how do we recenter free expression and critical thinking on our campus? A second was, how do we support faculty and help them with tools and practice so they can bring contentious issues into the classroom? And the third was, how do we go about actually measuring and what data are we already capturing on whether or not we're making a difference on our campuses?
And it seems like the timing really couldn't be better for both unveiling this program and having a group of college presidents active to meet a rise in student unrest, protest, and inflamed discourse on college campuses.
You know how sometimes in real estate you hear that it's all about location, location, location? In this case, I almost think about our work with college presidents as timing, 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 right? Because we literally went public on August 15th of 2023, right? And we announced 15 presidents. We had a few people raise their hands. And then October 7th happened, right? And suddenly the floodgates just opened. And I would say that many presidents came to us with two motivations. Number one was many of them were true believers that we needed to center civic preparation. And here was the moment for us to really use as a moment to accelerate that work. And at the same time, we also had presidents who also said, I want to do this, but how the heck do you go about doing this on a scaled basis, right? There are a lot of programs. Every single school you can talk to will say, oh, we have a center that does this, or we have some faculty members who are really good at civil discourse. But the question is, how do you do that not just on an opt-in basis so that every student on your campus actually learns these incredibly critical civil discourse, constructive dialogue, community problem solving skills, right? To be able to take perspective, have empathy, humility, and be able to work together in common cause. And so we are seeing some amazing things happening on campuses, and yet we're still in the early stages of that work.
At the time of this interview, there's over 60 college presidents involved in the Civic Preparedness Program. What does membership mean for those enrolled, and is there any criteria to meet before joining?
That's right. So when presidents join, they actually acknowledge and champion our civic commitments. And the civic commitments really are three major commitments. The first is that educating for democracy is central to the mission of higher education. Second is that we will prepare our students for a vibrant, diverse and contentious society. And then the third is to protect and defend free inquiry as a bedrock principle of higher education. Those commitments, when our presidents sign up and champion those, they say, A, they'll do this publicly. B, they say, and they share with us, how will they do this on their campuses, right? What am I doing? What other things am I going to do on my campus this year? And then C, they come back to us at the end of the year to tell us how they did, because every year we will publish an annual impact report with themes and how are we doing? What are we seeing on all of these campuses? So that's what, when a president says that they will become part of college presidents for civic preparedness, that's what they mean.
And for those joining to learn how to build on those civic commitments you mentioned, what does that training process look like and who facilitates that mentorship?
So it works, not surprisingly, differently at different levels. So we bring our presidents together both in person once a year and virtually in gatherings where we bring speakers and deal with very specific issues in the moment. I'll just use as an example that we scheduled on for April 23rd, a virtual gathering of our presidents. Just unbeknownst to us, we decided to focus on student protest and activism on campus. And literally, as we were having that conversation, some presidents were saying, hey, look, they're building tents outside on our Cannon Green. And so we bring together really thoughtful speakers, presidents who have gone through these experiences. We had 27 college presidents join us for that gathering to be able to learn from each other. And it's incredibly valuable.
This year, we've seen some really intense cracking down on student movements from administration and often outside police forces. Can you share any examples of colleges that you feel are getting it right and are doing a better job in meeting their students with this type of engagement?
So I would say, first thing, that every single institution is different, right? You walk on one campus, you walk on one campus. And so how our partner at institutions like Notre Dame versus Dartmouth versus Howard versus the University of Pittsburgh versus Claremont McKenna College versus Rollins College, how they address this is really specific to the institution itself, their history and their precedents. I will say that the things that we've been advising and talking to our presidents about, and in the end, it's really their call, is that you have to have this interesting balance, right? You have to be able to provide the opportunity for protest, but you don't have to tell them that it's okay to do it anywhere or everywhere, or that they can do it with masks, or that they can be external folks on campus. But you need to also be honest about the fact that there's a difference between violence and civil disobedience, and be able to look at that and understand at the same time the students have to understand the consequences if they actually engage in civil disobedience. And then as much as possible is to work with students and understand they're still students. They're still young people that are still learning, right? And so working in good faith, as long as the students work in good faith, is really, really important.
Taking a broad look at how this year has played out, are there any changes to the training initiatives or bolstering of programming planned for next year?
Oh, absolutely. Our presidents are trying to be very proactive about how they think, especially about the fall, right? You've got everything that happened in the spring and being able to be prepared. But let's not forget, right? This is an election year, and we're going to have the election in November. And so how do you prepare to both be able to support students in their rights of free expression and also free inquiry and to vote and so on and so forth, and also ensure that at the same time that the campus is safe is going to be critical in this endeavor. And so there's a number of conversations that we're having and supporting our presidents as they work through this.
where does the funding for these initiatives come from? And is there any financial incentive for colleges to join the program?
So great question. The way in which we construct the funding is it's philanthropically supported. And one of the things that I take great pride in is that our philanthropic foundation partners come from across the ideological spectrum, right? They're really varied. They believe in this work. We also do charge our schools for some of the work that we do. And one of the places that philanthropy is helpful is that, you know, not all schools have endowments of large size. Some of them are small institutions. Some of them are underfunded and undercapitalized. Others are small regional state universities and so on. And so we have to bring philanthropy to be able to support making sure that any institution that wants to take part in this work can be part of this work. The more schools, the more college presidents we can get to be part of this, the more important it'll be in terms of the knowledge base that we can create to help each other, the narrative that we can also shift, and then finally, the momentum that we can create as a higher ed sector around these issues and championing the civic commitments that are core to the work that we're doing.
What would you say is at risk for democracy or society at large to fail at this civic mission in which you've embarked upon?
So look, at its core, and this is really the motivating, activating force at the Institute for Citizens and Scholars, we need to have a citizenry that's engaged and effective. It is the only way that one sustains a democracy. You need them to be well-informed, productively engaged, committed to democracy in America, and we will thrive. That is the only way that we have self-representing government.
Thank you, Rajiv, for taking the time to speak with us. Are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave us with?
So when it comes to the College Presidents for Civic Preparedness, be on the lookout, because not only are we growing, we're still seeking other institutions to join us, but we're learning so much about the good that's also happening on our campuses. So as I often say, I'm able to hold two competing thoughts in my head. Number one is that every single day, there are thousands of productive interactions among students, faculty, and administrators that really do help in the learning of the students and the adults. And yet at the same time, we need to continue to do an even better job. And those two things are both true. And it's what gives me hope and energy when I think about the work that we're doing.
Rajiv Vinakota is president of the Institute for Citizens and Scholars. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Jody Cowan. This has been the Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1763. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, WAMC.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.